Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
My personal pursuit of justice for the I can give you I think it might be an example, and that is I work with a lot of men, more men than women, and I work with a lot of traumatized people, and they come to work with a lot of issues, and sometimes it gets the best of me and sometimes it doesn't. But the one thing that, for example, I've been harassed many times, and what I don't do for the most part, and I'm not saying that a woman doesn't have a right to report it, but, for example, I may decide, well, I'm not going to report it because I'm not going to the white people on this particular person, particularly if it's something that I think I can handle. Now, if it's something extreme where the person is making it impossible for me to do my job or they're physically doing things, then that's different. Then you have to protect yourself. But I try to, you know, endure some discomfort as opposed to aiding and abetting the system and getting rid of another black person. Particularly, you know, and I work with black men, so it would be a black man. So that's something that I resisted. I've never done that, gone to the man on them. And I say, not to say women shouldn't or men shouldn't. If you feel that it's, you know, it's up to the individual to decide how serious the harassment is. But I try to learn to deal with it with some, you know, I mean, I try to learn to diffuse it. And I do a fairly good job to the point where a lot of guys say, "She, something wrong with her. She's weird." That's cool. If I'm weird enough, you won't want to sleep with me, right? Okay, no problem. So I just try not to engage the system against black people any more than I have to. But, yeah, of course, that's there. But and it's sad, too, because what's happened, in my opinion, is black people have become predatory because we don't understand the forces that are acting against us. And so we've become predatory where the men are preying on the women in certain kind of male ways, and the humanness and the empathy has gone out of a lot of the relations and sexual relations between black males and females. And so that's what I'm hoping, that, you know, by us talking about it and people writing about it, that we all become less confused, and then we can help other people become less confused by not feeding into it. What I did do, I think it's on the website, I printed up the excerpt of Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. I made the first excerpt was What Are Black Gender Wars? And give examples of that. And the one statement that we do make is, and I'll just read this real quickly, how did black gender wars begin? They began during slavery when slave owners pitted the male slave against the female, parent against child, house slave against field slave, and light-skinned slaves against dark-skinned slaves. After our original African culture was destroyed during slavery and blacks were forced to integrate into the white culture, we began to imitate the dysfunctional relationship between the white male and white female. To this day, the materialistic, sexist, and antagonistic white male-female relationship has become the standard for most black relationships. However, it is futile and self-defeating for black males to imitate white male sexism because black males lack the power to effectively practice it. In reality, black male sexism actually weakens the black male's ability to overcome his racist oppression because it alienates the black female at a critical time when her full cooperation is desperately needed. In other words, the black male needs the support and respect of black females collectively to transform himself from slave Negro to self-respecting black man. And perhaps if you think it might be beneficial, you could, if you think it'd be beneficial, you know, you're free to print up any excerpts, pass them out, email them, and maybe that could start a conversation, maybe with somebody that you're having some issues with. Maybe you could say, you know, why don't you read this and tell me what you think? Because we're fighting each other because we don't understand what happened to us, and we don't understand even why we're fighting. And black men have come to a society that has been ruled by white male sexism, and they think that some think this is the correct way to treat women. But they don't, you know, what they overlook is, do you really want to have relationships like they have? And can you afford to alienate your only ally? So that's just a suggestion. Maybe that could be a conversation point with maybe some of the people that you're dealing with.
Thanks so much for that, Pam. Really appreciate that.
Okay, thank you for the question.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, September 14th, 2018. So I have been told this is our third study session on Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, co-authored by Pam the Great, Miss Pamela Evans Harris. We are picking up on recipe number 6. I think Pam would want us to keep that in mind. Black people are traumatized people. That was one of the goals for her writing this book and putting all of this information together. To keep that in mind and to hopefully allow some of this information to help mediate how we treat, think about, conduct ourselves with other black people, including ourselves. That said, we will get started. We are on recipe number 6. Pam the Great, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, Context of White Supremacy.
Recipe number 6, the Post-Traumatic Slavery Syndrome. Quote, when the white Columbine kids got killed, the whole country felt sorry for them. Black kids get killed every day and nobody cares. The only time we get any attention is when we mess up. Nobody asks us if we are messed up because of all the killings we sing. They just lock us up and throw away the key. End quote. Jamal, 17, Chicago. Quote, over 605 black children have been shot and or killed in Chicago from 2007 to 2009. More than the total number of soldiers from Illinois who have died in the Iraq or Afghanistan wars combined. End quote. Philip Jackson, The Black Star Project, Chicago, Illinois, 2009. Chapter 15, Building the Case for the Post-Traumatic Slavery Syndrome. Quote, to understand the present, you must embrace your past. End quote. Umoja. Post-traumatic stress disorders are not new. Webster's Dictionary defines the post-traumatic stress disorder as a psychological reaction that occurs after a highly stressful event, like witnessing a murder or being the victim of a violent crime. The term post-traumatic stress disorder is so widely accepted by the medical and psychiatric community that it has become a household name. The medical community and the entire nation empathized with the survivors of youth-related tragedies like the Columbine, 1999, and Virginia Tech, 2008, shootings, because they recognized that one traumatic event can permanently damage an individual. Researchers found even a minor trauma, like getting stuck in an elevator, created PTSD symptoms in some white college students. Post-traumatic stress disorders can affect the offspring of survivors. To an article by the American Academy of Experts in Traumatic Stress, AAETS, the emotional wounds of Jewish Holocaust survivors may have seeped into the psyches of many of their children. The article also stated that the children of Holocaust survivors were at greater risk for depression, anxiety, and PTSD symptoms because of their exposure to their traumatized parents. Another study in 1998 found that the children of Holocaust survivors reported Holocaust-related thoughts and images as their primary traumas. The total lack of interest by the mainstream media, law enforcement, and the white collective in general in the almost daily murders of Black children in America may explain their callous dismissal of the post-traumatic slavery syndrome, PTSS, and why this term cannot be found in any Webster's dictionary. In this chapter, the authors will attempt to do what the mainstream media, the medical psychiatric communities, and the guardians of Webster's dictionary refuse to do: acknowledge the post-traumatic slavery syndrome as a legitimate disorder and demonstrate how PTSS is the single biggest cause of Black gender wars between Black male and female. Chapter 16, The Post-Traumatic Slavery Syndrome, PTSS, is the foundation for today's Black gender wars. Let's begin at the beginning by defining the post-traumatic slavery syndrome. Question: what is the post-traumatic slavery syndrome, PTSS? Answer: PTSS is the psychological trauma of the transatlantic slave trade and 150 years of post-slavery racism. Question: what is the transatlantic slave trade? Answer: transatlantic refers to the transport of African slaves via the Atlantic Ocean from Africa to North America, Europe, Brazil, and the Caribbean. Question: if slavery has existed since the beginning of time, what makes American slavery so different? Answer: prior to the transatlantic slave trade, slavery had never involved the deliberate psychological destruction of the slaves. We know this happened to African slaves in America because there are historical documents, photographs, audio recordings, and living witnesses who told their stories before they died. Question: isn't post-traumatic slavery syndrome just an excuse so that Blacks can avoid taking responsibility for their present condition? Answer: the descendants of slaves who are still oppressed by modern-day racism do not have to make any excuses for being victims any more than a rape victim has to make excuses for being raped over and over. The rapist is always responsible for his crime, regardless of how easy or how hard the victim or victims fought back. Question: isn't it disrespectful to Jews to use the word Holocaust to describe the transatlantic slave trade? Answer: the Jewish Holocaust lasted 12 years from 1933 to 1945. The African Holocaust lasted over 400 years, from approximately 1441 to 1865. The answer should be obvious. Question: doesn't teaching slavery teach Blacks to hate whites? Answer: when Jews teach their children and the world about the Jewish Holocaust, are they accused of teaching hate? Not only do Blacks have the right to teach our children and the rest of the world about our African Holocaust, we have an obligation. It is not the history of slavery that creates racial animosity towards whites. It's the lack of respect for that history. It is the unwillingness of the white collective to admit slavery was a crime against humanity and their refusal to acknowledge the wealth that Black labor contributed to America. Most of all, it is the continuation of racism, white supremacy, 150 years after slavery, that creates the most racial animosity towards whites. Until the victims are made whole, whites will continue to be on the defensive and in denial, and conscious Blacks will continue to be offended. Question: why should whites who never owned any slaves be held accountable for something that happened over 100 years ago? Answer: it doesn't matter if the ancestors of a few, some, or all whites owned slaves. All whites have benefited from a white supremacy system that was built on the backs of millions of African slaves who contributed 400 years of free labor. Even whites who did not own slaves still participated in the oppression of blacks via the economic, educational, and employment discrimination that started during slavery and continues to this day. Question: why don't blacks blame the African chiefs who sold their ancestors into slavery? Answer: number one, African chiefs did not ship one African out of Africa. Number two, Africans did not own the ships that sailed to America. Number three, Africans did not benefit from 400 years of free labor. Number four, African slave labor did not make Africa one of the richest nations on earth. Number five, the ones who profited the most and did the most psychological damage are the most to blame, not the African chiefs who sold the losers of the tribal wars. Question: is post-traumatic slavery syndrome a ploy to get reparations by making whites feel guilty? Answer: it is more important to repair the bond between the black male and female than it is to induce white guilt. Guilt is non-productive for the victims of racism because it rarely results in a change of behavior of those who benefited from the injustice. In fact, too much guilt actually increases resentment and the tendency to justify one's behavior rather than correct it. Question: why should whites recognize PTSS if they do not benefit? Answer: whenever a group commits a great injustice against another group and sincerely make amends for their crimes, they make the world safer for everyone, including themselves. However, when a group commits an injustice but refuses to acknowledge it or make amends, they lose their humanity and put themselves, their group, and their nation at great spiritual risk. Question: what about the immigrants who faced ethnic discrimination when they came to America? Do they deserve reparations? Answer: comparing immigrants who came to America voluntarily with slaves who were kidnapped and enslaved for 400 years is as logical as comparing an apple to an elephant. However, if any immigrant group feels their experience is equivalent to 400 years of slavery, let them present their historical evidence in the forms of documents, photos, audio recordings, witnesses, slave journals, etc., to back up their claims. If they cannot present any historical evidence, then the following statements are logical and true. No other ethnic group, including immigrants, was brought to America chained together in the holds of slave ships. No other ethnic group in America, including immigrants, was raped, lynched, burned, tortured, dismembered, and murdered for sport and for profit for 400 years. No other ethnic group in America, including immigrants, was stripped of their religion, culture, language, identity, and history. No other ethnic group in America, including immigrants, stood naked on slave auction blocks to determine their market value. No other ethnic group in America, including immigrants, contributed 400 years of free labor and received nothing in return. No other ethnic group in America lost 12 million souls in a transatlantic slave trade. Question: What about all the government reparations for blacks, like welfare, food stamps, and affirmative action? Answer, social services are not reparations. Whites receive the vast majority of benefits from all government entitlement programs like welfare, food stamps, college grants, Social Security, Medicare, farm subsidies to big farmers, bank bailouts, and huge tax breaks for corporate welfare. Most blacks, like most non-blacks, work and pay taxes. Blacks have fought in every war America has ever fought, from the Revolutionary War to Iraq and Afghanistan, even while being denied our basic human rights. Despite the long history of slavery, service, and sacrifice to America, blacks are still accused of getting a free ride at the white taxpayers' expense. Some Americans are more outraged over the tiny monthly sum poor black women and children receive than they are about the white-owned multinational corporations that pay zero income taxes and ship American jobs overseas. Even if some blacks receive welfare, that has nothing to do with reparations for 400 years of free labor any more than U.S. aid to Israel wipes out the demands for reparations for the Jewish Holocaust. Question. What about all the progress blacks have made in America? Doesn't that contradict the existence of PTSS? Answer. Whatever progress blacks have made in America, it was hard won. True lack of progress can be easily seen in the growing inequality between blacks and whites. According to a new study by Brandeis University in May 2010, the typical white family is 5 times richer than its black counterpart of the same class. Tom Shapiro, one of the authors of the report, stated, quote, there are greater opportunities and less challenges for low and moderate income families if they're white in comparison to if they're African American or Hispanic, end quote. This study reveals the high financial cost of integration on the economic underdevelopment of black people. Quote, wealth among the highest income African Americans has actually fallen in recent years, while among white counterparts of similar class and income, it has surged, end quote. Quote, the gap between black and white household wealth quadrupled from 1984 to 2007, totally discrediting the conventional wisdom that the U.S. is slowly and fitfully moving towards racial equality or some rough economic parity between the races. Like most American myths, it is the direct opposite of truth. When measured over decades, blacks are being propelled economically downward relative to whites at quickening speed, according to a new study by Brandeis University, end quote, the Black Agenda Report. Question, does PTSS explain why blacks are so inferior? Answer, there is a huge difference between being in an inferior position and being inferior. It is illogical to think or to expect black people collectively to be equal to whites after we were denied equal educational, social, economic, and political opportunities for over 500 years. Question, quote, isn't this black generation a little too far removed to be able to attribute our behaviors to slavery? To segregation, racism, socioeconomic disparities, of course, but I can't even trace an ancestor who had a master, end quote. Black female college student, 21. Answer, that's correct to an extent. Slavery alone is not responsible for the condition of blacks today. It was the massive damage of slavery combined with the massive damage from 150 years of racist oppression that are responsible for the conditions of blacks today. It is illogical and self-defeating to minimize 400 years of slavery and only focus on the 150 years after slavery. Slavery laid the foundation for mass Black dysfunction, but was not totally responsible for the end result. If Blacks were truly inferior, why was new legislation needed to halt Black progress? The answers should be obvious. Question: does the post-traumatic slavery syndrome mean Black people are permanently damaged? Answer: no, but it is impossible for Blacks to fully recover from PTSS in a Black-hating, white supremacist society, just as it is impossible to recover from tuberculosis if you are trapped inside a TB ward and constantly reinfected. Question: is there a cure for PTSS? If so, what is it? Answer: there are only two permanent cures for PTSS. Total elimination of racism, white supremacy from the planet, for Blacks to separate completely from the white supremacist culture, white values, and white people. Once Black people have been returned to an environment and culture where it is normal and desirable to be Black, our natural African instincts buried under 500 years of white supremacy programming will return. Question: if PTSS is a legitimate psychological disorder, why doesn't the medical and psychiatric community recognize it as such? Answer: there are four possible reasons. The American medical psychiatric community is a reflection and an extension of the white supremacy system. 400 years of free slave labor would qualify millions of Black descendants for massive reparations from America and Europe, since both nations participated in and profited greatly from slavery. Acknowledging PTSS as a legitimate syndrome would remove the stigma, lie, of Black inferiority from the descendants of slaves, and would correctly place the majority of the blame for mass Black dysfunction where it rightfully belongs, on the white supremacy system. However, in a white supremacy system, this admission would be intolerable and completely unacceptable. Recognizing PTSS as a legitimate disorder would make it official that slavery was a massive crime against humanity, and it would publicly identify the criminals who committed those crimes and who is obligated to pay for those crimes. It would also establish one more indisputable fact: that most of America's and Europe's wealth came from 400 years of African slave labor. Question: how should Blacks respond when the post-traumatic slavery syndrome is ridiculed or dismissed? A, by not wasting our precious time and energy trying to convince anyone of what we know to be true, that 500 years of repeated trauma has damaged our entire race. What is more important is understanding how PTSS still affects Blacks 150 years after slavery officially ended. Once we understand what the post-traumatic slavery syndrome is and how it still affects our thinking and behavior, we can take corrective actions to neutralize its effect. We do not need permission or approval to break the financial and psychological chains of slavery. It is time to stop asking for it. The victims should never make the feelings of their victimizers a priority or even a consideration. Question: the post-traumatic slavery syndrome sounds so doom and gloom. Are there any positive lessons to be learned from it? Answer: absolutely. Enslaved Africans survived the worst that mankind and womankind could conceive, and their descendants are still standing. The list of accomplishments by Black inventors, scientists, surgeons, scholars, and builders is too long for one book, so we will not attempt to list them here. That being said, the survival skills developed during slavery are the same survival skills many Blacks draw upon today to overcome racism and poverty. By learning the lessons from our past, we can rebuild the Black male, Black female relationship and will be able to say with confidence, never again. Chapter 17, PTSS and the Stockholm Syndrome. Quote, "We Blacks just can't get enough of them whites. It's the Stockholm Syndrome. We love people who are over you and put you down. It's some sort of freaky love. It's something innate inside of us that makes us want to forgive." End quote. Paul Mooney. The Stockholm Syndrome was coined by criminologist Nils Beger Rote after the 1973 Norrmalmstorg robbery in Stockholm, in which several bank robbers held four bank employees hostage for 6 days, August 23rd to August 28th, 1973. By the time the victims were freed from their six-day ordeal, they had become so emotionally attached to their victimizers, they were defending them. According to Beger Rope, the Stockholm Syndrome is more likely to develop when the captives are in a situation where their captors have complete control over their basic needs for survival and whether they live or die. The psychological effects of Stockholm Syndrome on its victims. Once the captives are isolated from the outside world, they will become totally dependent on their captors for their basic survival needs. The captives will develop a sense of gratitude toward their captors for allowing them to live, and will begin to view their world and their reality from the captor's perspective. Captors may occasionally use violence to prove they can kill the captives at any time they choose, thus persuading the captives that it is safer to endure captivity than to resist and risk serious injury or death. However, the captors know excessive cruelty will make their captives hate them and rebel against them, so the most cunning captors perform occasional acts of kindness to encourage their victims to focus on their good side. Once the captives believe their captors are their benefactors, the good guys, they will develop a sense of loyalty that is stronger than their loyalty to other captives or even themselves. The survival instinct makes the captives reluctant to hate or even dislike their captors because they are too dependent on them. A recent example of Stockholm Syndrome. 1991, 11-year-old J.C. Lee Dugard was kidnapped, raped, and held captive for 18 years by Philip Garrido. In 2009, when the parole officer of her abductor became suspicious, Dugard tried to protect her abductor by posing as a battered wife hiding from an abusive husband instead of revealing her identity and obtaining her freedom. Her description of her rapist kidnapper, quote, "a great person who was good with her kids," end quote. The most profound and overlooked example of Stockholm Syndrome, the 400-year transatlantic slave trade. Once the slaves are isolated from the outside world, they will become totally dependent on slave owners for their basic survival needs. The slaves will develop a sense of gratitude towards the slave owners for allowing them to live and will begin to view the world and their reality from the slave owner's perspective. Slave owners occasionally use violence to prove they can kill the slaves anytime they choose, thus persuading slaves that it is safer to endure captivity than resist and risk serious injury or death. However, the slave owners know excessive cruelty will make their slaves hate them and rebel against them. So the most cunning slave owners perform occasional acts of kindness to encourage their slaves to focus on their good side. Once the slaves believe their slave owners or their benefactors, the good guys, they will develop a sense of loyalty that is stronger than their loyalty to other slaves or even to themselves. Fear and the instinct for survival makes the slaves reluctant to hate or even dislike the slave owners because they are too dependent on them. Even 150 years after slavery, many blacks secretly view the small privileges we receive, like getting service with a smile at a white-owned restaurant or store, or being able to sit next to whites on a bus, train, or airplane, as a kindness rather than a human right. As long as blacks receive the smallest courtesies, we are more likely to overlook the more devastating and more telling acts of cruelty and racism that are being committed against black people on a daily basis, including employment and housing discrimination, inferior schools, predatory lending, incarceration, police brutality, and entertainment terrorism against blacks. If four bank employees in Stockholm, Sweden can be psychologically traumatized after a six-day ordeal, it is logical to assume that a black human being who is traumatized by racism from cradle to grave is by birthright a lifetime candidate for the Stockholm Syndrome. Chapter 18, PTSS and Learned Helplessness. The Martin Seligman Experiment, 1967. Martin Seligman, an American psychologist and a world-renowned authority on abnormal psychology, made an unexpected discovery while he was conducting experiments on depression. These experiments led to the theory of learned helplessness, which refers to a human being or an animal who is conditioned to think he cannot change his circumstances, even when the opportunity presents itself. The Learned Helplessness Experiment, Part 1. Three groups of dogs were placed in identical harnesses. Group 1 dogs were released after being restrained for a set period of time. Group 2 and Group 3 dogs were yoked together in pairs. Group 2 dogs were given an electric shock, which the dogs could stop by pressing a lever. Group 3 dogs received an identical shock, but could not stop the shock even if they pressed the lever. The Group 1 and Group 2 dogs recovered from the experience. The Group 3 dogs had already learned that ending the shocks was out of their control and as a result became depressed, hopeless, and helpless. The Learned Helplessness Experiment, Part 2. The same three groups of dogs were put into a box-like apparatus. The dogs could escape the electric shocks by jumping over a low partition. The Group 1 and Group 2 dogs escaped the shocks, but the Group 3 dogs that had learned previously that nothing they did would stop the pain lay down and whined. Even though Group 3 dogs could have followed the examples of Group 1 and Group 2 dogs and escaped, they had been conditioned to feel so helpless they didn't try. The lesson? If a person has been repeatedly abused and have tried and failed to stop the abuse, he or she will become demoralized, numb, apathetic, depressed, and helpless. The best example of learned helplessness in a human population are the descendants of African slaves. After 500 years of slavery and oppression, many blacks deep down believe that no matter how hard they try, they cannot eliminate the pain of racism and eventually learn to function as a helpless population. The good news, One-third of the Group 3 dogs eventually escaped the shocks, proof that it is possible to unlearn the syndrome of learned helplessness and release ourselves from our paralyzed condition. Recipe number 7, racism, white supremacy. Quote, if you do not understand white supremacy, racism, what it is and how it works, everything else that you understand will only confuse you. End quote. Neely Fuller Jr., 1971. Chapter 19, what is racism, white supremacy? Quote, racism is white supremacy. White supremacy is racism. There is no other form. End quote. Neely Fuller Jr. Let's begin at the beginning by defining the words. White supremacy, a social, economic, and political system based on the belief that whites are superior to non-whites, the foundation. Racism, the systematic discrimination, the denial of rights and benefits by whites against non-whites in all areas of human activity. Number 1, economics. Number 2, education. Number 3, entertainment. Number 4, labor. Number 5, law. Number 6, politics. Number 7, religion. Number 8, sex. And number 9, war, the behavior. Racism equals power plus prejudice. Question, why is it called racism, white supremacy? Answer, because this describes exactly who is practicing the racism. For one group to practice racism, that group must have more power than another group. Since whites control all the major areas of human activity in America, housing, education, health, entertainment, economics, politics, law, and religion, it is accurate to define all racism as white supremacy. We must be accurate so the victims of racism do not become confused. Question, isn't all racism the same regardless of who is practicing it? Answer, there is only one kind of racism, white supremacy. White people are the only group in America with the power to discriminate, deprive, or punish other ethnic groups and the systems and institutions to maintain the imbalance of power. For example, rich people are more powerful than poor people. Rich people have the power to discriminate against poor people by depriving them of income, promotions, jobs, housing, land, justice, and any other rights if they choose to do so. Racism is not empty rhetoric, words, or mindless emotion. Racism is social, economic, and political power. In America, whites have the power to discriminate against blacks and other non-whites by depriving them of income, promotion, jobs, housing, land, and any other rights if they choose to do so. It doesn't matter that some whites are poorer than some blacks. In all things and in all places in America, whites are collectively more powerful than blacks are collectively. This imbalance of white power creates the opportunity and the ability to practice racism against non-whites. Question, why do you refer to non-whites as groups instead of races? Answer, because there is only one race, the white race. To prove this statement, let's look at the true meaning of race. In ancient civilizations, tens of thousands of years ago, before Europeans inhabited the planet, the world's people identified themselves by bloodline, birthplace, and culture, but never by the artificial construct concept of race. What is the Black race in real terms? It does not describe the place where Black people were born, because there's no such place as Black land, or red, yellow, brown, or white land. Race does not describe a person's religion, because there is no such thing as a Black, red, brown, yellow, or white religion. Race does not describe a person's culture except in false, stereotypical terms, and it does not define biology, ethnicity, or nationality. Race does not describe skin color, because the so-called Black race includes people whose complexions range from the palest pink to the purest blue-black. Therefore, race is a false and man-made concept. Question: if race is a false concept, why was it created? Answer: race was created only for one purpose, to practice racism. To practice racism, whites had to separate themselves from other groups of people by artificially creating different races. Question: why was racism, white supremacy, created? Answer: Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, a Black psychiatrist and the author of the ISIS papers, The Keys to the Color, 1991, states that white supremacy is practiced by the global white minority on the conscious and the unconscious level to ensure their genetic survival by any means necessary. Because of their numerical inadequacy, whites may have defensively developed, quote, an uncontrollable sense of hostility and aggression towards people of color, and developed a social, political, and economic structure to give Blacks and other non-whites the appearance of being inferior, end quote. The authors will add one more reason. Racism, white supremacy was created to allow the people who classified themselves as white to economically, socially, politically, sexually, psychologically, and genetically dominate all the people who they classify as non-white. Question: who decides what race a person will be? Answer: the same white people who created the concept of race. If the only purpose of race is to practice racism, and whites are the only group or race in a white supremacy system that can practice racism, then it is logical to assume there is only one race, the white race. Question: if the white race is the only race, what are the other groups called? Answer: there are three types of people in a white supremacist system. Number one, non-white people. Number two, white people, racist suspects. Or number three, white supremacists, racists. Question: what is a non-white person? Answer: anyone who is not classified as white. This includes all Black, red, yellow, and brown people, aka people of color. Question: what is a racist suspect? Answer: any white person who is capable of practicing racism against non-whites. Since all whites are able to practice racism in a white supremacy system if they choose to do so, it is correct and logical to use the term racist suspects to identify whites who do not openly function as white supremacist racists. This is not a hateful, unjust, or racist statement, but it is a logical statement. Question: what is a white supremacist? Answer: a white person, a racist, who practices racism against non-whites. Being a white supremacist has nothing to do with income, title, or status. It does not mean a white person belongs to the KKK, the Aryan Nation, or is covered with Nazi tattoos. A white supremacist can be a soccer mom, a businessman, or a U.S. senator if they are practicing racism against non-whites. Another term for a white supremacist is racist man and racist woman. Question: how can a non-white person determine if a white person is racist? Answer: non-whites cannot always determine who is a racist and who is not, because it is impossible to monitor or judge all the individual actions and words of any white person at all times. To illustrate this point, the case of the stolen wallet. There are five people in a room when a wallet that belongs to a sixth person who is not in the room is stolen. All five are suspects because every person in the room had the ability and the opportunity to take the wallet. This does not mean all five are thieves, nor does it mean all five are not thieves, because any of them could have stolen something at an earlier time. As it turns out, two of the five people in the room conspired to steal the wallet by breaking into the sixth person's locker. The other three saw it happen, did not participate in the crime, did not care that the wallet was stolen, and did and said nothing to stop it from happening. The sixth person, the owner of the wallet, has no idea who stole it, if anyone saw what happened, or how many participated in the theft. All he knows is he has been the victim of a crime because his wallet is missing. The two people who stole the wallet are guilty of commission. They actually committed the crime. The three witnesses are guilty of omission, since they witnessed the crime, said nothing, and did nothing to stop it, and refused to help the victim with the information they had. The next day, the two thieves treat the three witnesses to lunch, paying for it with the money stolen from the wallet. The witnesses did not steal the wallet, but are knowingly or unknowingly benefiting from the theft. The three witnesses are not legally liable, but they are morally liable and are correctly viewed as suspects by the victim. Racism operates the same way. There are whites who are practicing racism against non-whites at a particular moment, are not practicing racism at that moment, but have practiced it at a previous time or will practice it at a later time, are not practicing racism at that moment, but say and do nothing to stop those who are not practicing racism at that moment, but have no problem with other whites practicing racism, don't care, are benefiting from the crime of racism, even if they are not practicing racism at that moment, refuse to tell who is practicing racism, how racism is being practiced, and refuse to help the victims with the information they have, oppose racism by exposing and opposing the whites who practice it. Another example: Mr. X, a Black management trainee, is looking for an apartment closer to his job. He calls an upscale rental complex near his office and asks if they have any one-bedroom apartments. The rental agent, a young white male, says there are two one-bedroom apartments available, takes Mr. X's name and phone number, and asks him to stop by and fill out an application. The next day, Mr. X stops by the complex after work. A different rental agent, Mrs. W., a middle-aged white female, greets him in the reception area. She says she's sorry, but there are no apartments available. She suggests he fill out an application so they will have his information on file, and assures Mr. X that he will be the first one she calls when a one-bedroom becomes available. Mr. X is immediately suspicious, but he fills out an application anyway. On his way home, he replays the conversation with the rental agent. Mr. X has no way of knowing if the first rental agent made an honest mistake or if he has just been a victim of racial discrimination. His gut tells him it was the latter. The crime. When Mrs. W. saw Mr. X was black, she used the same line she always used with black applicants. Later, she warns the new rental agent, who talked to Mr. X over the phone, to never rent to blacks or Hispanics. The victim. Like the man whose wallet was stolen, Mr. X is the victim of a crime. The problem is, Mr. X can't be sure a crime was even committed, which makes it even more difficult for him to protect himself from being victimized in the future. It is this kind of confusion that wreaks the most psychological damage on black people who run a daily risk of being victimized by racism without being able to prove they were victimized. The criminals. Mrs. W. is guilty of commission practicing racism. The new rental agent is guilty of omission because he said and did nothing and refused to help Mr. X with the information he had. That other white person, Mrs. W., was practicing racism. It is the crime of commission and omission that allows the system of racism, white supremacy, to function so effectively. The system does not require all whites to practice racism at all times, but it does require that the majority of whites say and do nothing when racism is occurring and allow themselves to benefit from the victimization of non-whites. Those benefits include better jobs, housing, food, medical care, education, police protection, justice, etc., than non-whites. If the majority of whites were opposed to racism, white supremacy, it would not be the most powerful social, economic, and political system on the planet. It is logical to assume that the majority, or possibly all, white people have made a deliberate decision to do one or all of the following. Practice racism. Do nothing and say nothing to stop others from practicing racism. Deny racism is being practiced even when they know it is happening. Refuse to help the victims of racism with the information they have. That's why simple-minded thinking is useless when determining which white person is a racist and which one is not. It cannot be determined by a white person's sexual behavior. White slave owners had sexual relations with male and female slaves, but they were still white supremacist racists. Whites have engaged in sexual relations with black people, but that doesn't mean they are not racist. Whites who have black friends, wives, husbands, or children are still racist if they are practicing racism against non-whites. It cannot be determined by observing the words or the actions of a particular white person who may or may not be practicing racism at that particular time. It cannot be determined by a random or deliberate act or acts of kindness toward a non-white person. Mass child murderer John Gacy was kind to children when he performed in his clown costume. There were slave owners who were kind to their slaves, but not kind enough to stop selling human beings. Axiom number one, you cannot oppose something and knowingly benefit from it at the same time. It is logical in a white supremacist society to assume the majority of whites are either practicing racism, the act of commission, or are cooperating with those who are by saying and doing nothing to stop them, refusing to help the victims of racism with the information they have, the act of omission, and are benefiting from the practice of racism. Question, do non-racist whites benefit from white supremacy? Answer, all whites benefit from white privilege in a white supremacy system, even if they are not practicing racism at that moment. It does not matter if they are rich or poor, or whether they admit there is such a thing as white privilege. Anyone who is classified as white in a white supremacy system will always have advantages over someone who is not. Just as a black person in a black supremacy system, if one existed, would have advantages over someone who is not black. Question: aren't some white people opposed to racism? Answer: only if they are saying and doing something to oppose it. For example, John Brown, a white male, encouraged armed insurrection by slaves as a means to end slavery, and as a result, was charged with treason and hanged. However, that does not mean John Brown did not practice racism at an earlier time or would not have practiced it at a later time had he lived. Question: aren't white anti-racists opposed to racism? Answer: the self-anointed white anti-racist activist offers little more than lip service. They sacrifice nothing, take no risks, and reap more financial rewards than the black activists fighting in the real trenches. The white anti-racist actually creates more confusion by creating the false illusion that the devastated black masses can be liberated from racism by sitting in a church, auditorium, or conference room listening to a white person who is still enjoying his or her white privileges making anti-racism speeches. It is unlikely that the same white anti-racist activists who profit from writing books and giving speeches about racism have any real desire or intent to destroy the same white supremacy system that allows them to oppose it without losing a single white privilege. There may be whites who are sincere about replacing the system of white supremacy with a system of justice, but that number is so statistically small, it is insignificant. Question: when a black person mistreats a white person, isn't that racism black supremacy? Answer: no, because black supremacy does not exist. If black people were collectively more powerful than whites collectively, blacks would have the power to practice racism. Logically speaking, that would mean the end of white supremacy. Axiom number two: black supremacy can exist only in the total absence of white supremacy. White supremacy can exist only in the total absence of black supremacy. The textbook definition of supremacy is the highest rank or authority. This means only one thing can be supreme or occupy the highest rank at a time. If blacks and whites had equal power and resources, there could be no black supremacy or white supremacy. Our ability, power to discriminate against, mistreat each other would be canceled out, leaving only two options: coexist peacefully or destroy each other.
Pam the Great, Context of White Supremacy. That is the first audio segment for this week's session of the book study. We will be back for the second audio segment once we finish up with our commentary. Before we get to the callers, again, all of our listeners, victims of white supremacy in the Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina area, I hope everyone is taking massive precautions, is relocated, hopefully, someplace safe, and doing all they can to make sure that they and folks that you care about are well with the major storm on the East Coast. Been trying to keep up with that. As I said, even though I am in Washington State, I was born in Virginia, so lots of familiarity connections with that region. That said, also want to acknowledge a failure. Pamela Evans Harris, Pam the Great, she was on the program many, many times. On one of those visits, we talked about Superstorm Sandy. Racism, white supremacy that was practiced there. And specifically, we talked about Glenda Moore, black mother who was not helped by whites, and two of her children drowned during Superstorm Sandy. She blogged about that online, and we talked about that on the program. I just have been struggling to locate exactly where we talked about that, because we were actually... That's a whole nother issue in terms of why there are some difficulties in locating exactly where. But we talked about that on the program. I just couldn't find it. That would have been, I was really hoping to get that audio segment included. We can track it down. I'll play it for the compensatory call-in tomorrow. If you have commentary you would like to share, the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Can get in one of the jokes. One of the reasons I'm having difficulty locating exactly where we talked about Superstorm Sandy. Superstorm Sandy happened October of 2012. If you can rewind back, something else major was happening at that same time, particularly here in the United States, November 2012, presidential election. Blame that one on that damn Obama as well. Me not being able to locate this because most of the commentary at that time is greatly focused on, is President Obama going to get another 4 years? But anywho, number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. Just make sure that we don't have to grapple over a lot of unnecessary disruptions in the background. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your commentary, that would be grand. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Gus, this reminded me what you just said. You know, when we read the book on Katrina, how it started with the guy, and he went to put the baby on the ledge, and he turned around, and the baby was going in the water, and the mother went to find the baby. Man, I hope everyone in harm's way is doing well as well. It might sound like I'm being critical, but I'm not. I'm just have a different recollection of things, how things pan out for me. But hard to hear again, taking away our history and giving it to African people and propagandizing the third to the fifth most important piece of racism ever made, called Out of Africa Theory. Charles Darwin, Sam Galton, and Frenchman Franz Boas, who's the teacher of W.E.D. Du Bois. Look those people up. That's who came up with it. PTSD. My man Mel calls it CTSD, current traumatic stress disorder. But, what's more traumatic for victims? And this is a matter of perspective. Our ancestors being put on slave ships, kidnapped with the assistance from their own people, brought here to America from Africa, being killed and enslaved for hundreds of years, and then today, knowing the condition of Africa, they're in America being traumatized by white people, or being home in America and some people killing and enslaving their ancestors who fought for hundreds of years against them, taking your land and enslaving your people, and then convince you you came from a whole other place of the world called Africa while they're sitting here traumatizing you. That's just a matter of perspective. One just makes me have a little bit more incentive in the system. The breakdown of Stockholm Syndrome was right on point. Why it should be called racism, white supremacy. In my conscious circle of people, I face opposition from everyone I speak to, with the exception of Imhon Deasy, about using the word racism, white supremacy. And it's all different reasons, and I usually explain, and they disagree. So instead of argue, I just ask them what's a more accurate term to describe it, and I never get a sufficient enough answer to even respond back to them, so I just leave it alone. White, non-white, racist, suspect, and white supremacists. I never liked this. I've been listening for years. I didn't like it until I saw Tariq Nasheed use it on Fox News in real time, because the host asked him, is he saying all white people are racist? And he responded by saying, there are two types of white people. You have white people and you have white supremacists. So she had no comeback for that. And I said, wow, you know, that made sense. So I started using it after that, because if I get new information, I implement it. And I think that was this year, and I've been listening for how long? But I use non-white now too. However, I do think it's necessary when talking to black people to describe the type of non-white person you're talking about, because that will confuse other black people, or people being classified as black rather. I can't wait to use non-white the next time a white person asks me to describe someone. Oh, he's a non-white person. And see what their next question is going to be after that. That's going to be epic. That's it. Thank you for taking my call, Gus.
For sure. For sure. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hello, everyone. I'm calling from California. Just getting off the plantation. I'm just tuning in now, so I'm not sure what has been spoken on before I'll be calling in. But I guess I'll just piggyback off of what Thomas in New York commented on about the CTSD. You can switch out the word current for consistent. I will say, as non-white people, Aboriginal people, I would say the entire world belongs to non-white people.
I want to hit the pause button here on your commentary, sir. This goes for everybody, so they'll just know this moving forward. This is a book club. I don't know if you understand that. This is a book club. So you understand that we're talking about Black Love as a revolutionary act. This is not just like random commentary.
Apologies, sir. Then I'll just nuke my line from there. Thank you.
No apology needed, but that is one for the book club specifically, because we have had people that will acknowledge that they did not hear any of what was read in the book and they didn't do any of the reading beforehand, but they still want to comment. That is one that does irk me, because, you know, you're not really addressing what's being talked about on the program. And this is a program where I do like to be on topic with what we are discussing, not a indictment, but just trying to stay on topic, because we're not talking about the book. It can float to all kinds of things. Other folks who dialed in, if you had commentary, if we've not heard from you, line should be open. Proceed.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, we have Mr. Demery 4. I'm actually going to pause Mr. Demery 4 because I said I'm conceding my talk time on this one so that we can include audio from Pam. This one is actually audio with Pam and Mr. Demery 4 about Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, and it's very specific to the exact section of the book we just read. So this is Mr. Demery Ford questioning Pam about what we just read, 2011, a few weeks after the book was just published.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Pam.
Greetings.
Gus, and the other listeners. I was just about to press one, but it looked like Gus had a little premonition there. But I would like to hear some discussion about recipe number six.
Number six.
PTSS, okay. Post-traumatic slavery syndrome, mm-hmm. and specifically the Stockholm syndrome,
okay.
and how it plays an active role in relationships even today.
Okay. Just to make it quick, and I'm glad you got a copy of the book, obviously. I believe that the Stockholm syndrome perfectly illustrated the psychological dilemma of black people today. For example, and I think Gus, you had read it before on, okay. So what we're saying is the Stockholm syndrome, basically, for those who may not be aware of it, was a phrase that was created after some bank robbers held some black bank employees for hostage for 6 days in a bank in Sweden. And what happened was by the time the victims were released from their ordeal, and it was a six-day ordeal, they had become attached to their victimizers, the people who had held them captive, and they were actually defending them. And they say basically Stockholm syndrome develops when people are in a situation where their captors have complete control over them, including whether they live or die. So it goes about this way. You isolate, you know, the captors are isolated from the outside world, and the captors, the people kidnap them, become their world. And so when you look at black people, it's almost like we were kidnapped by aliens. And if you can imagine yourself, you and your family are in bed, and one minute you're in a spaceship and you're going to another planet. You don't know where you are. The people look strange. They don't look anything like you. They're frightening, and they're cruel. And so what is going to be your main instinct? And that is to find a way to survive. Well, after they give you a little food, and they give you a little water, and they don't mistreat your children, even though they beat your husband, the fact that they let you live, you psychologically, you're trying to survive psychologically as well as physically. So now you have to find a way to survive psychologically. And that is, you have to transform your reality into something that you can live with. And by doing that, you start to take the little bit of kindness they give you as a great big deal, because you know they could kill you at any time, because they've killed some other people, other humans right in front of you. So the fact that they let you live, it's like they did you a favor. And you forget that they put you in that situation. You're just grateful for the little bit of crumbs that you get. And I can't speak for anybody else, but when I go into a place where I'm served by a white person, waited on by a white person, particularly if I'm in a white area, and they're nice to me, I feel like, whoo, that's a relief. Forgetting that you're supposed to serve me. You're supposed to give me service with a smile. You're supposed to be courteous. That's your job. You're getting paid to do that. But instead, I'm giving this white person extra credit because my expectation is so minimal and my humanity is so degraded that any little thing they do for me, I'm grateful for. Now I'm so dependent on them that any little thing they do, I'm like, shut up, don't rock the boat, or they might stop doing this for us. So now I'm attacking other captives, because I don't want to rile the captors, because they might take away what little bit I'm getting. So when you look at black people, I don't really believe black people love white people. I believe that we've been accused of that, but I don't believe that any more than an abused woman really loves her husband. And actually, there's going to be a scenario in the third book, describing how black people are like an abused woman. So we take the abused woman syndrome, and we apply it to, if you apply it to black people's situation, it fits perfectly, in my opinion. You've got this husband that, I'm using a man, not the man bash, but just because that's a typical situation. You've got a husband, tells his wife all the time. He marries her now, which makes her think he must be okay to him, but he's always putting her down. Ooh, your hair is horrible. Yeah, look at your features. You need plastic surgery. Your body is out of shape. You're just ugly. Nobody else would want you. Okay, So then she's always trying to please him. She's trying to prove he can be a good wife. She starts exercising. Nothing she does pleases him. Then he brings her home flowers after one night that he beats her and gives her a black eye. The next day he brings her flowers. And she starts thinking, well, he's not all bad. And when her family says, why don't you leave him? He says, he bought me flowers. So she's forgetting about the fact he's cruel to her most of the time. She's concentrating on the tiny little things he does for her because now she's let herself be validated by him and let him define her value as a person. So black people act in the same way, in my opinion, with white people. Despite all the cruelty, all the mistreatment, all the history, all the long, long history of brutality, they do the least little thing for us. And we're like that abused woman who just got the flowers after she got her butt beat. So Stockholm Syndrome to me and all of that kind of fits in together is the psychological condition of a people who are so dependent on that victimizer's validation and that victimizer's handouts that they become loyal to the victimizer. And if you try to stop that man from beating that woman's butt, guess what? She's going to jump on you, right? And how many times do black people jump on other black people for telling the truth about racism? And when those bank robbers were captured by the police, the people they had been holding hostage were defending them. So that's about, you know, didn't mean to go too long with it, but all that stuff is the same mentality. You are so grateful for the little crumbs you get that you forget about all of the bad stuff that put you in that position in the first place. I hope, did that answer your question? Or did you?
Yes, it did. And I just wanted to say that I'm enjoying your work, and it just goes a long way to show how far we actually have left to go. Mm-hmm. When we look at the complexities, you know, of what's going on inside of our minds, you know, what type of work we have to do, even with the knowledge that we are gathering, we still have to constantly, you know, be on guard and to have information, you know, like your work and, you know, to help us to clarify our thoughts and, you know, to organize, you know, our efforts. So I just want to applaud Gus for his work. And, you know, I really enjoy, you know, when you are on the show, but I listen to the show all the time, and I'm going to continue to read, and I'm still on the first book, but I have to get through with it so that I can get on with, you know, what I need to be doing. But thank you very much, and I'm just going to sign off for now, but I really enjoyed the show, and keep up the good work, Gus.
Pam the Great. So that's 7 years ago. Thank you for your patience, Mr. Demery. For you want to retract anything that you said from 2011?
No. Actually, I was kind of proud of myself for understanding that at that period of time, I had quite a bit of confusion going on. But Pam, that's a good place for me to speak on her. She was so good at simplifying things, and it took, you know, things that she put in the book, just reading this chapter right here, it took me about 5 years to be able to understand this stuff. And she just simplified it. You read the book, and you may have to ponder on some parts of it, like white people being the only race, things like that. But if you stick with it, you'll begin to see exactly what she's talking about. And it will, like she would always say, it will empower you, you know, to know this. So thanks for that, Gus. I mean, that helps me on a little gauge on how far, you know, I've come along. That was something big with me. You know, what's going on inside our minds, the damage that white people have done to us from the transatlantic slave trade. And then to know that there is a cure. Well, first you have to realize that it exists, and then you can start to heal, you know, with respect and hope. So, you know, I think that covered the part. It's no argument on the PTSD. We were affected, you know, by what happened to us collectively, you know, so we accept that. But then we want to know that it's hope that we can, you know, learn something to empower ourselves, you know, that we don't have to just continue to be victimized, you know, without any recourse. She answered some very important questions. How can a non-white person determine if a white person is a racist? That's something Mr. Williams had asked me many years ago. I think it was around 2007 or whatever. And actually, I could not answer that. But she said, non-whites cannot always determine who is a racist and who is not, because it's impossible to monitor or judge all the individual actions and words of any white people at all times. And I say, if a white person can practice racism, have the ability to practice racism, then they probably will. And if you put them all in that category, you know, you be closer to the truth than what you would be for not having any type of strategy on what to do. And this thing about whites opposing racism, I have to admit, you know, this is going to be strange, but Mr. Demery Ford himself used to think that Gus was a little hard on the white people, you know, that he had on the show. And, you know, it took me a little while before I realized that before the show was over, almost every time, the white people would show their true colors, and Gus would illustrate the point, you know, what he was saying. That would show me how far behind I was. And the first time that I heard Tim Wise, the white anti-racist speaker, you know, I thought he was, you know, right on. And I couldn't see anything wrong with that. And then until, you know, further listening and learning and taking notes from Gus and from Mr. Fuller, you can see how these people are. You cannot oppose something, like Pam say, and knowingly benefit from it at the same time. So they're either committing racism, or they are actually practicing racism from omission. So I think that just about covers all of them. And I'll yield some of my time. Maybe I'll be able to come back a little later. Thanks for the clip, Gus, and greetings to everyone. Thank you.
Much obliged.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. Just wanted to start off by saying I think I understand that a lot of the information that Ms. Pam has in a book is specifying this part of the world. But as a reminder, we must also understand that racism and white supremacy is a global dynamic. Rich, poor. I heard the term rich, and people identify the opposite as poor. I really don't know and or understand the definition of the two words. Some people identify rich as something, a piece of food substance that's actually very, very sweet. So, I mean, it has too many meanings for me, as far as that concern. The question of races that she brought up in the book was very important. And yes, there is only one race. I, in my discourse with a lot of non-white victims, especially the non-white victims who are racially classified as black, normally seems to have a problem with that subject, because I don't think that we actually take some time with ourselves personally and think about that idea that there's only one race of people. Our confusion have confused us to the standpoint to where we actually have developed something called pride for one's quote unquote race. Someone even wrote a popular song that we talked about a few weeks ago that says, "Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud." And we really didn't have anything to do with it at all. Moving on, the case of the stolen wallet is a great example, I think, of the operative history practice of racism by whites who don't necessarily know each other and maybe don't even like each other personally, but is a codified means that they utilize to mistreat people who are non-white. Excuse me, I'm down here. I've been down here in South Florida for a long time. Anytime I hear that word Hispanic, I cringe because it promotes a whole lot of confusion, the word itself. Sexual relations is too, in my opinion, too much of an inaccurate term when it comes to white people and their sexual activities, even with themselves. But I would say with them sexually trashing people, or basically I would identify it as crime when they're in sexual contact with non-white people. And that's all I have to say. Thank you. I'm looking forward to the second reading. Very, very good book to read. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary you'd like to share, proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Ivy.
Greetings.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers on the line. Like, oh my God, like, this book is just, it's so incredible. But I want to bring up something real quick from last week. How they addressed, you know, the black men who have children by multiple women. I will say that even though that I would say is statistically insignificant because we're just not having children, we need to have more. Black women, I don't know very many black women who don't have children by multiple fathers, by multiple men. And so it's not just men doing this, like, black women are doing this a lot. But man, the rebuttals to the questions that are in the book are just incredible. I thought it was incredible. I might use that word so many times for when she brought up white feelings and how they shouldn't be even considered. And the occasional kindness, just to get us to focus on those things and not other things, and how that kindness actually works, where we do just the slightest things that they do, we love it and we forget about and ignore things like just, you know, denying us employment and so many other atrocities, murdering us and everything else. Just the horrible terrorism that they inflict on us about learned helplessness. I thought that was just incredible, her commentary on that. And I got to echo Mr. Demery in terms of the job that you're doing with this program, because there's a lot of, and I understand it, there's a lot of learned, and I've experienced it, a lot of learned helplessness when it comes to eliminating white supremacy. And I'm sure that you've had your struggles, but you have not ultimately given in to that. And you've been doing this program for, you know, almost a decade. And you could have given up a long time ago. I mean, because you've watched, or you know of Mr. Fuller and Dr. Welsing trying to eliminate the system for decades, and just so many decades, and it's still here. but yet you still have endured for over a decade trying to solve this problem, and you're not giving up. I like what she talked about the construct, and I want to use the great grandsister, Dr. Welsing, her phrase, I'm almost done, her phrase, power construct. I mean, that to me, because whites say social construct, it's not really that. It's not really a socializing type of situation. This is a power construct. So I just think that's brilliant. And then Pam, she would always talk about, because the book brought up, she brought up like why the system is here. And Pam used to always talk about the infertility of whites. I think that's awesome what she said. And when she talked about in the book that we don't love whites, we just, you know, have the Stockholm syndrome, plus we don't want to be hurt by them. To echo Mr. Demi Ford, when he talked about how she was able to simplify complex things, that speaks to her brilliance, because in order for you to be able to simplify something, you have to be clear. And in order for you to be clear, you have to understand your subject. The last two things I want to say is that I love how she mentioned the alleged anti-racist and how she exposed, how they exposed them and talked about, you know, what their problem is and how they're fake and they're not to be trusted. And the last thing is, I wonder if after we eliminate white supremacy, if we can even trust whites at all to, you know, try to bring this system back. I don't know. We should mess with them, just period. But anyway, so I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Ivy. Others that have not spoken, proceed.
Can you hear me?
Greetings, Jay in St. Louis.
Hello to everybody on the line. I think you guys have made great contributions. And I want to build off of the point I made about the style I've noticed so far. I tuned in late, but I did notice immediately Pam's writing style and how she really simplified these really complex ideas and in a question answer. So I like how she says, you know, like, what is white supremacy? So what is racism? How does a white person, you know, practice racism? And then comes back with an answer that all fits together, especially the questions and the order they're presented. I think it's brilliant. So I wanted to mention that. And I also wanted to echo a point from, I think, Mr. Dean before about PTSD or Stockholm Syndrome. I know those are two unrelated terms, but insofar as they are related, I think the psychological impact of white supremacy continues to show itself. Specifically, what Pam mentioned, the Stockholm Syndrome and our reveling and our joy at their weakest validations. And I think that desire, that implanted desire, or as Ivy may have more correctly characterized it, as our fear of them, our rational fear of, you know, these people or things, these constructs, this walking death, it may be, you know, or whatever, our fear of them, I think it shows itself in the way we do other things, not only the way we love each other and how intolerant we are of other Black people when they make mistakes, while also searching for this validation and giving them so many breaks. And all they have to do is just kiss a Black baby and do the gym, you know, do the jitterbug and we love them again. Or how much we validate them for doing the very dances that we shame our children for doing, getting the very care that we shame ourselves for liking. All these weird contradictions come up. So I think, you know, what I have heard of the book, especially in the archives, I've enjoyed so far, and I'm glad I was able to stay up this week and just say that I'm really enjoying the book. Thanks.
Much obliged, Jay in St. Louis. Any other folks that have a hand up commentary they would like to share on the first audio segment? Did we nab everyone? We didn't miss anybody who has a hand up.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, this is EW from Florida, first time caller. I've been listening, and one thing I did want to point out, I noticed with Pam with the books, it's the same section in like multiple books, like in this one and also in, what is it, the International Con Game? Yeah, I noticed that it was some of the same sections, and I appreciate that, actually. I'm a firm believer of like repetition, it's the father of learning. So I think that's a really good way to drive the message home. Also, Ivy, she commented on like the men with, you know, having children with multiple women. And I think that would also be like a symptom of the PTS, like from slavery, like as we were taught it to be, the males, they were used as studs and bulls, and, you know, the families were ripped apart. So it's still going. That's what I would think. I mean, that kind of backs up what Pam and, you know, Emoji is saying. So I don't know, even with the females, they were used, you know, just to breed. So that's some of the things I was saying. So I don't know. I'm slow down. I'm a little nervous. First time caller. Sorry. But I think that's all I really had. So I just want to add my opinion. So thank you. I'll meet my line.
Thank you so much for dialing in. Don't be nervous. Victims of racism exchanging views. That is, you know, all it is. Important, but nothing to be nervous about. Thank you kindly for sharing. Just quickly to your point about the repetition. Pam the Great, she discussed that and said that that was done intentionally because, number one, they did not want to assume that everyone had read all of their books. Like, this is the second book that they publish. They didn't want to assume that people had read Trojan Horse, Death of a Dark Nation, which covers some of the fundamentals, like some of the things that we just read. What is racism, white supremacy, and, you know, just fundamentals. So that's why some of these sections are in many of the books, the Interracial Con Game as well, because you can't really have intelligent dialogue on this subject if you don't have a coherent definition for racism, white supremacy, which they include so that everybody at least knows what you are talking about. But they were very strategic about the repetition of specific portions. With that, we have to get to the second audio segment. We have about 2 minutes. Did we miss anybody? Anybody have a hand up that has not shared at all? The caller at last four digits, 4753. Did you have commentary that you wanted to share? You should be with us. It's difficult to hear you. Like, I don't know if you're far away from your microphone or if you.
Oh, 1 second. Oh. Is that better?
Yes, sir.
Okay, this is Rob in San Diego. Just getting off work, I did miss the first audio segment, but I will just respond to the title of the book. Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. Relocating from Milwaukee to San Diego and being in the quote-unquote ghetto where you are the minority, I don't see many Black people. And it seems that in the state of California, quote unquote interracial dating is very encouraged. So the title of Pam's book is very brilliant, very important. And just to reiterate, Black love is a revolutionary act. Being in this type of environment makes me desire a Black woman even more. And thank you for taking the call. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Rob in California. Did we miss anybody? Anybody that has a hand? Well, if we missed you, you will not have very much time to speak at all. But did we miss anybody?
Okay, I'll assume we got everybody for right now. Does anybody have anything that they can get in like 30 seconds?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I want to quickly say, JSA Lewis, what you just said about lauding whites for what we chide each other for, absolutely incredibly brilliant. I'll mute my line.
Right on, right on. And with that, we will get to the second audio segment, Pamela Evans Harris. Pam the Great, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. Outstanding job with the narration. We have multiple narrators for this text. We will be transitioning next week, new narration. Picking up next week, but fantastic job from everyone who has participated in the narration. Extremely professional, high quality work. Much obliged for your contributions. Audio segment number two, Context of White Supremacy.
Chapter 20, How White Supremacy Damages Black People. Given our painful 500-year history of white oppression, do blacks hate whites? A better question, can blacks who depend on white institutions and systems for survival afford to hate whites? It would be less confusing if all whites were openly racist, but that is not the case. Black paranoia is a natural byproduct of racism, white supremacy. Whenever we are denied a job, a promotion, or stopped by the police, followed by store security, denied a loan, told there are no apartments available, or are seated at a table near a swinging kitchen door, it is difficult to tell if race was a factor. Today's racism is more refined and more subtle, which makes it more psychologically and financially devastating because the victims become confused. If we attempt to be reasonable, we wonder if we had been the victim of discrimination or if we just had an unpleasant encounter with a disagreeable human being who just happened to be white. If we are angry, bitter, and tired, an understandable reaction to living black in a white supremacist society, we may feel that everything is about skin color and that every white person who denies us something we want or says something we don't like is a racist. This is why our focus must be on understanding how the system of white supremacy works and all the different faces it wears. If we judge racism solely on our pleasant or unpleasant interactions with whites or by individual whites we like or love, we will confuse ourselves and draw faulty conclusions. For example, we might assume that a white person who is nice to us can't be a racist, untrue, and a white person who is not nice to us must be practicing racism, untrue. It is the collective and individual behaviors of white people who function as racists and racist suspects that results in systemic racism, white supremacy. To answer the question, do blacks hate whites, is no. Do blacks fear, resent, and distrust whites? Absolutely, whether we admit it or not. It is natural to distrust a member of a group that has a history of mistreating your group. It is natural to fear someone who has the power to abuse you and get away with it. It is natural to resent someone who benefits from your mistreatment, knows you are being abused, but says and does nothing to stop the abuse. This is not the definition of hate. This is the law of physics. For every action, there is a reaction. To accuse blacks of being as racist as whites, when whites collectively have the power and a 500-year history of practicing racism against blacks makes as much sense as comparing the schoolyard bully to a bullied child who now fears and dislikes the bully because of the way the bully has treated him. Quote, I am quite certain that there will never be healing between blacks and whites in this country until whites face up to the crime we as a people committed against people of African descent and begin to set it right. That is the only way blacks will ever be able to genuinely respect us. And, odd as it may seem, it's the only way we'll ever be able to respect them, because no one can feel clean, at ease with, and respectful with someone they've robbed and brutalized and then felt they got away with it. Working toward mutual respect is the only way to bring about true racial harmony. Anything else is divisive. End quote. Donna Lamb, CURE, Caucasians United for Reparations and Emancipation. Axiom number 4. In a system of white supremacy, it is natural for black people collectively to fear and resent white people collectively. The consequences of speaking openly and honestly about racism can be severe, so many blacks remain silent. Out of fear and confusion, we allow ourselves to be drawn deeper into a false and dangerous sense of security, forgetting there is no security for black people within a black-hating society. To survive and advance in a predominantly white workplace, blacks often feel they must wear a compliant mask in the presence of whites for the same reason an employee hides his feelings from a boss that he does not like or trust. Quote, I keep my voice even and low in meetings because if I raise it, the white people would get scared, end quote, said one black male Hollywood insider who preferred to remain anonymous. Quote, I can't afford to be perceived as an angry black man. But the truth is, I'm angry most of the time. People think my job is glamorous, but they have no idea how racist this business is. End quote. The dangers of black denial. When we hide our true feelings about racism, we're not protecting white people. We're protecting ourselves from the wrath of white people. We've learned from the painful and sometimes fatal experiences of others who have dared to speak out that many whites cannot handle an honest dialogue about racism and will deny racism is happening even when it is happening right under their noses. It is understandable why blacks feel we must mask our anger and outrage in order to function in a white supremacist society. The real danger comes from wearing our mask in private when we're alone. Our denial of our true reality creates a weak psychological foundation that can easily crack under pressure. Instead of confronting and correcting the source of our pain, we self-medicate with food, alcoholism, and drug addictions, violence, ego trips, risky sexual behaviors, infidelity, promiscuity, poor parenting, obesity, overspending, materialism, violence, irrationality, and over-emotionalism. The psychiatric community defines depression as rage turned inward. What then is the deadly manifestation of rage turned inward and outward? Is it a form of racial schizophrenia? The misdirection, suppression, and self-medication of rage accounts for a majority of high blood pressure, stroke, cancer, mental illness, schizophrenia, drug and alcohol addiction, depression, suicides, and murders that plague the black community. Many blacks avoid examining their true feelings about racism because they are terrified that once they do, they won't be able to continue functioning, smiling, grinning, tap dancing, denying, and pretending as an inferior person within a white supremacist, black-hating society. We are reluctant to face the truth because once we face our real problem, racism, white supremacy, we can no longer avoid the responsibility for fixing it. Without realizing it, our ineffective coping strategy, surrender, actually extends the life and the power of the white supremacist system. Black amnesia is anti-historical and self-genocidal. We must stop being naive about racism. Racism is not about whites liking or disliking blacks, or about blacks liking or disliking whites. Racism is not about blacks and whites knowing each other better. Racism is not about more blacks living next door or going to the same schools as whites or any such nonsense. Increasing the crossover appeal of black entertainers will not end racism. As a famous black comedian with huge crossover appeal once observed, quote, "I don't understand what goes on sometimes, right? Because here we are in this theater, we're getting along just fine. We go outside and shit changes," end quote. Comedian Richard Pryor speaking on racism. Sammy Davis Jr. was one of white America's favorite entertainers during the 1950s and 1960s, yet this rich and famous black man could not stay in the same hotels where he received standing ovations. We forgot or didn't understand that even the most rabid monkey hater will pay a fortune to see a monkey sing, talk, and tap dance. We forgot that in the segregated Deep South, whites and blacks lived next door to each other and played together as children, but that did not eliminate racism. Southern whites certainly knew the black women who cleaned their houses, raised their children, cooked their food, and nursed white infants at the black woman's breast. Black domestic workers were just like family to their white employers, but this did not protect them from being victimized by the same racist segregation laws that were condoned by their white pseudo-family members. Racial sensitivity and diversity training will not end racism. Blacks and whites living, learning, working, or eating together in the same neighborhoods, schools, workplaces, or restaurants will not end racism. Racism will not end until white supremacy ends. White supremacy will not end until non-whites in every part of the world change their responses to it. Quote, "Hence, I have no mercy or compassion in me for a society that will crush people and then penalize them for not being able to stand up under the weight." End quote. Malcolm X, 1925 through 1965. Recipe number 8. Integration. Quote, "No, there is plenty wrong with Negroes. They had no society. They're robots, automatons, no minds of their own. I hate to say that about us, but it's the truth. They are a black body with a white brain. Like the monster Frankenstein, the top part is your bourgeois Negro. He's your integrator. He's not interested in his poor black brothers. He's usually so deep in debt from trying to copy the white man's social habits that he doesn't have time to worry about nothing else. They buy the most expensive clothes and cars and eat the cheapest food. They act more like the white man than a white man does himself." End quote. Malcolm X. Chapter 21. Integration, American dream or African nightmare? In a materialistic society like America, where resources are plentiful but are unequally and unjustly distributed, greed and selfishness are the predictable byproducts. A culture that defines success as accumulating more things than we need instead of sharing our excess with those in need will breed a population that believes it is normal, even desirable, to be greedy and selfish. An epidemic of materialism and selfishness is systematically destroying our friendships, relationships, marriages, families, and communities. We were not this way prior to integration. Before integration. The civil rights movement was a living testimony to our willingness to make personal sacrifices for the common good of all Black people. Even though slavery had destroyed the African family, the family still meant everything to former slaves and their descendants. The strength of the Black family was our extended families of aunts, uncles, grandfathers, grandmothers, sisters, cousins, nieces, nephews, and neighbors who were just like family. It was common in Black families for two or three generations to live in the same home or on the same street. In 1925, only 3% of Black families were headed by women. The marriage rate for Blacks during the Great Depression was higher than the marriage rate for whites, even though Blacks were more likely to be poor than whites. During the Depression, white vagrants often relied on the generosity of poor, rural Blacks for a hot meal or handout, even when they could not count on their own kind. Despite our limited resources, Black people once had a reputation for being the most generous and forgiving people in the nation. In the pre-integration South, there were no latchkey kids. There was always a neighbor or a relative willing to fill in where the parents left off, so no child came home to a cold, empty house. Before integration, Black men and women, regardless of income and education, knew they needed each other and knew there was safety in numbers. We had to rely on and cooperate with each other because we did not have the option of moving to a white suburb. Before integration, Black men and women knew the importance of family and would have rejected the programming of trash talk shows and their degrading and racist baby mama daddy dramas. Before integration, the vast majority of Black men had to get married if they wanted a home, children, respectability, and regular sex. Before integration, our children reaped the benefits of experience and wisdom that spanned two or three generations, from grandpa and grandma to the elderly Mr. and Mrs. Jones who lived down the block. Black children learned to respect their elders because no one gave them a choice. Despite all our progress in America, the Black marriage rate is lower today than it was during the Great Depression, and our divorce rate is the highest it has ever been. Over 70% of Black children live in a single female-headed household, and MTV, BET, VH1, gangster rappers, and the streets are the value creators for much of today's Black generation. What happened to us? Integration. We adopted the white majority culture's materialistic and non-spiritual value systems and began to worship money and material things instead of our Creator. Some of us got a taste of the good life and began to embrace poisonous individualism, forgetting that our safety and prosperity in a hostile white nation always came from us standing together. Thanks to the 24-hour, 7 days a week mass media machine, we were bombarded by fraudulent images of happiness, sexiness, status, and success, always defined in white materialistic terms. The rampant materialism of celebrities, athletes, and an increasing number of handpicked showcase blacks with their non-black spouses taught us what real success looked like, and it didn't look like black loving black. We began to define our own black self-worth by what we owned instead of who we were. The more assimilated into and surrendered to the white majority culture, the more materialistic, self-centered, black-hating, and black self-disrespecting we became. Those who managed to carve out a bigger slice of the American pie began to look down on those who hadn't. Some of us bought into the myth, lie, that poor blacks were poor because they wanted to be poor. Many first-generation, college-degreed, white-collar, and business-suit-wearing black males and females began to separate themselves psychologically and physically from the black masses. I wear a suit and tie to work, so I'm better than someone who is poor or gets their hands dirty. We began to value each other less or more depending on the material goodies our potential partners brought to the table and how well they measured up by white standards. Character and kindness fell sharply on our gotta have list, and we focused more on competing with the kinds of lifestyles we saw whites leading on and off screen. As the number of successful and professional blacks increased, so did our egos, vanity, materialism, arrogance, white identification, and broken black families. Blacks, who were once the most sexually conservative people in the nation, eagerly embraced the dominant culture's sexual immorality and perversity. We started swinging and swapping spouses because white people were doing it, and some of us started swinging both ways. Our new mantra became, if it feels good, do it, and worry about the consequences later, even if our children were the ones who paid for our bad behavior. We integrated, surrendered, our round, black, African identities to fit into a square. Black-hating, white culture, and some of us desperately sought racial redemption in a pair of white arms and told ourselves we're living the American dream. We began to believe and act like we didn't need each other. Some of us put all our faith in the illusion of inclusion and believed that since we were part of white America, we did not need to develop a black America. We took inordinate pride in the tiny number of showcase blacks who dazzled us with their high-profile positions, fame, $1,000 suits, and $1 million homes. We were awed by their ability to mix, mingle, date, and mate with whites, even while the so-called best and brightest blacks ignored the rising poverty and despair of their own people. We didn't understand that celebrating another first black after 500 years in America wasn't a sign of progress. It was proof of a lack of progress. And we forgot our enemies always put aside their individualism to move against us as a unified, well-organized, and well-financed group. Lessons we can learn from non-white immigrants. 40 years after integration, the black collective, regardless of education or income, is more dependent on whites than we were 50 years ago. To make matters worse, we're just as dependent on the non-white immigrants who just got off the boat for the majority of goods and services sold in the Black community. These non-white immigrants focused on economic power, not on assimilating with whites. They stuck together, worked together, and built strong ethnic families, communities, and mega businesses together, usually right within the disunified Black community. Non-white immigrants know ethnic unity and strong families are the keys to economic prosperity. They seldom seek social acceptance, validation from whites because they know they will never get it, because they will never be white. They know it is bad business to get a good job in someone else's company instead of building their own. Instead of resenting their success, we should be studying and imitating them. If we could turn the civil rights clock back 45 years, which one would we choose? Social integration or economic empowerment? The answer can be found in the economically successful, tight-knit, non-white immigrant communities in America. Chapter 22, The Curse of Black Skin and White Eyes, The White Identified Black. Quote, it is impossible to achieve equality when one group has the power to deny rights to another group. Until we understand that distinction, we will not understand the difference between tolerance and acceptance. End quote. Umoja. What is a white identified black? A black person who views the world through a white lens and judges most or all events, people, places, actions, and things from a white perspective. What is the white collective perspective? The beliefs, opinions, behaviors, and value systems of whites as a group. The white collective perspective is based on what is normal, desirable, and beneficial for white people collectively. An example is the Rodney King beating case. In spite of videotaped evidence of police brutality, an all-white jury decided collectively that what benefited the white police officers benefited white people collectively. That perceived benefit resulted in an acquittal. Had it been the other way around, an unarmed white male beaten by black police officers, it is certain that an all-white jury would have convicted the black officers. The white collective would have correctly viewed an unarmed white person's beating by black policemen as potentially dangerous to all white people collectively, because that meant it could happen to any white person. The white collective would have acted in their collective best interest by punishing the black officers. In a racially divisive society like America, it is normal for the white collective to set standards that benefit their group and affirm their self-worth as white people collectively. This does not mean all white people think the same or share the same perspective in all things. What is the black collective perspective? The black collective operates on a similar principle that black people collectively should view most or all events, people, places, actions, and things from a perspective that assumes whatever benefits or harms a black person benefits or harms all blacks collectively. This does not mean all blacks think the same or share the same perspective in all things. From the black collective perspective, the beating of an unarmed black man by white police officers would have been correctly perceived as harmful to all black people, because the same thing could happen to any black person. Therefore, a black jury would be more likely to convict the white officers. The O.J. Simpson trial is another example of how the white collective and the black collective perceive their interests differently. The white collective assumed O.J. Simpson was guilty even before any evidence was heard, while the black collective saw Simpson's acquittal as justice for all blacks, not just Simpson. This does not mean all blacks believed that O.J. was innocent or that all whites believed O.J. was guilty. An individual may not agree with a group perspective on any or every issue, but it is undeniable this kind of group mentality exists within a racist society. It is normal for the black collective to set their own standards according to what benefits black people and affirms their self-worth as black people. However, due to black inferiority programming, which was accelerated by the integration and assimilation into a black-hating white culture, the black collective often acts against its own self-interest without understanding why they are doing it. It also explains most of the black collective's self-destructive behaviors. This inferiority programming is the main reason many blacks refuse to identify with the black collective because it is the black collective. Axiom number 7. A group whose collective actions penalizes their own group and rewards another group is self-destructive and self-genocidal. For this reason, the white identified black is a liability, not an asset to the black collective. Before we go further, let's define what a white identified black is not. What a white identified black person is not. This is not a condemnation of blacks who are often unfairly labeled as not black enough. All or most blacks are white identified to a smaller or a greater degree because we were raised in a white supremacist culture, America. It is the degree of white identification that determines the degree of the problem. Being white identified does not mean you prefer Beethoven to Beyonce or Madonna to Master P. It is not about our taste in food, music, art, or literature. It is not about the way we dress, wear our hair, walk, talk, sing, or dance. It is not about our level, income, or education, or the type of work we do. It is not about being smart or educated or speaking standard English or several languages that makes us white identified. All people, regardless of race, have a wide range of talents, interests, skills, and tastes, and are capable of enjoying a wide range of things for the simple sake of enjoyment. Black people are not monolithic, the same, nor are all white-identified blacks the same. What is a white-identified black? A white-identified black person is a black person who views the world through a white perspective, even when it conflicts with his or her own self and group interests. A white-identified black pursues interests, activities, and relationships primarily because white people are associated with them and often avoids or looks down on certain people, places, and things primarily because black people are associated with them. White identified blacks can be found anywhere at every income level, from the most exclusive gated community or Ivy League campus to an inner city housing project. How a black person sees black people, talks about black people, treats black people, feels about being a black person, and treats white people determines the degree of white identification. White supremacy is the foundation for the white perspective. The white collective perspective is based on the following principles. White is superior to non-white. White life is more valuable than non-white life. White people created everything worth creating. White is the most normal, the standard for all human beings. If white is the most normal, black must be the most abnormal. For those who doubt that this white standard exists, there is one indisputable piece of evidence that can be found in every medicine cabinet in America, the flesh-colored Band-Aid. In other words, the normal color for human flesh is the color closest to the skin color of white people. What does this say to the non-white person? That their skin color is not normal because they are not as human. Axiom number 8. Black normalcy cannot exist in a system of white supremacy. White identified blackness equals psychological suicide. By viewing the world through white eyes, white identified blacks are in the unenviable position of embracing their own inferiority and abnormality and have no choice but to be anti-black and anti-self. If the white identified black is observed interacting with whites or blacks, he or she will eventually reveal their own racial bias and inferiority complex by the things they say or do. Their confusion comes from trying to straddle the precarious line between the black world and the white world by serving two opposing masters at the same time, white supremacy and black normalcy. It is unnatural and perverted for a race of people to adopt a perspective and a set of standards that does not benefit their group and denies their own normalcy and self-worth as members of that group. Unfortunately, this kind of distorted thinking is exactly what has led to the personality disorders and self-hatred issues that plague the black population. Curing the disease of black abnormalcy. If whiteness is the norm, blackness must be the disease. The only cure is the assimilation of inferior blacks into a superior and normal white value system in order to reduce their black abnormalcy. This fear of being abnormal is the main reason some blacks become assimilated, white identified, so they will be normal by white standards. Unfortunately, white identified blacks will never be normal as white people because they will never be white. By accepting the false premise that white is the most normal, the white identified black is confirming his or her own genetic and intellectual inferiority. The white identified black person will never admit to being white identified, but will do anything to avoid being perceived as too black. When pro golfer Tiger Woods created a new term, Cablinasian, coined from the words Caucasian, Black, American Indian, and Asian, to describe his racial heritage, some people wondered why a man with a black father and an Asian mother would put Caucasian first in the racial pecking order. Ironically, despite Woods' attempt to racially reclassify himself, he is still known as a black golfer. In a white supremacist society, non-whites cannot racially reclassify themselves. Those who choose to forget this fact will be abruptly reminded. A blatant reminder occurred in 2008 when a solution was proposed by Kelly Tillman, a white female sports anchor, for younger golfers who wanted to challenge Tiger's title as the world's number one golfer. She suggested that they, quote, lynch him in a back alley, end quote. Tiger's response, quote, Kelly and I did speak. There was no ill intent. She regrets saying it. In my eyes, it's all said and done, end quote. The real question is not whether Tillman had ill intent. It's whether the word lynching would have been used to refer to a white golfer. It is similar to Fuzzy Zeller's comment at the 1997 Masters Tournament when he called Tiger that little boy and told him not to serve fried chicken or collard greens. The irony in these blatant racial reminders make the white-identified black more uncomfortable than the whites who had an unfortunate slip of the tongue. White-identified blacks are quick to forgive these kinds of comments because they are desperate to reassure whites that they are not angry blacks, even when they are being mistreated. This kind of behavior is more common for black males than females, since showing anger is taboo for black males who want to succeed with a white public. The downside of allowing racist comments to appear innocent is the black masses who do not have millions of dollars to insulate themselves from everyday racism are expected to suffer the same racist treatment without protesting. Quote, look at that black XYZ celebrity. He doesn't make a big deal out of a harmless comment about lynching niggers. So why should you, an ordinary nigger, get upset? End quote. A columnist for a major sports magazine also cast some doubt on the wisdom of Tiger's response. Quote, Woods doesn't have to become a civil rights spokesman, but he could have at least acknowledged that he understands the meaning of the word and how powerful and hurtful it remains, end quote. Beryl Evans, writer, reporter, Sports Illustrated. Their desperate desire to distance themselves from themselves and their despised blackness is the emotion that drives many white-identified blacks to deliberately seek out a white or Asian spouse to rid their offspring of the racial abnormalities that exist within themselves. This is why it is critical to recognize the symptoms of black denial and self-hatred so their disease will not infect us. The poisonous effect of white-identified black celebrities. White-identified black celebrities are extremely dangerous to other blacks because they validate black inferiority, white superiority, by the kinds of lifestyles and romantic choices they make. These successful white-identified black celebrities are more likely to be rewarded by the white supremacy system with lucrative book deals, talk shows, movies, and TV shows because they are the best advertising white supremacy can buy. Their fame, awards, and desperation to be embraced by the white elite and the white collective sends a deadly message to the black masses, especially to black youth. If you want to be rich and successful, be less black. The white-identified black person is the adult victim of the black doll, white doll experiment. White-identified blacks understand how tragic it is for the little black girl or boy to pick the white doll as the nicer doll, but cannot see how damaged they must be to do the same thing. If blacks are inferior, how does the white-identified black exempt him or herself from the same judgment? Some white-identified blacks adopt external gimmicks to maintain the illusion and delusion of black pride, like wearing African clothing, coconut beads, dreadlocks, and talking incessantly about the black struggle, all while imitating, secretly identifying with, sexing, and loving white. Because white-identified blacks usually get more crumbs from the white table than their black-identified peers, they are convinced that their external achievements and white validations are proof of their internal self-esteem, when in reality, it is just the opposite. Wealth, fame, status, titles, material things, or wearing dreadlocks and African clothing have nothing to do with self-esteem. However, self-esteem does require respect for the truth. Axiom number 9. A non-white person cannot be equal to or the same as a white person in a white supremacy system. To maintain the level of self-deception and denial needed to maintain their false white identity, the white-identified black person must create even more delusions, lies, as to their true status as a black person, a nigger, in a white supremacy system. This is why white-identified blacks are more vulnerable to the emotional devastation caused by racism because they don't think they will ever be victims of it.
That will do it for this week, cousins. Context of white supremacy. Pam the Great. Black love is a revolutionary act. Picking up next week, I believe we'll be on chapter 22. Moving right along. New narrator picking up next week. Great job. First portion of the book. We're about halfway through the book, basically. Folks can be thinking about major points that they're taking away. If you have questions, comments, thoughts that you'd like to share on the text, the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Please do not wait till the last minute. We have less than 30 minutes remaining in the broadcast. So if you know you would like to share a thought, go ahead and get your hand up, *61 right now. I will give a quick glance just to see if there's any folks on the line that we have not heard from at all. If you have not spoken at all, you should definitely get a hand up now. Other than that, all the folks who dialed in who do have a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can Ivy here?
Yes, ma'am. Greetings, Ivy.
I'm pulling up my notes here. Oh my goodness. Okay. You know, incredible book. I took like a million notes with all this anyway. So I would say that desegregation is definitely not our problem at all. When we were segregated, they did Tulsa. We didn't have nothing then, and what we did have, they burned it up, and they just continue to do that, building freeways over our businesses, bridges, playgrounds next to them, raiding our businesses on trumped-up charges, mass incarcerating us, just, you know, all kinds of things, and just, you know, even if it wasn't for desegregation, they still would have found a way, because they're going to, you know, practice racism. We just need to take the system down and eliminate it. I would say that, you know, that 70% number about our children in single parent homes, that's not true. It's 50% at best. That source is from that stat that was stated in the book is from it's talking about unmarried parents, and it's excluding parents that are living together, and even excluding parents that people who are married, children who have step-parents. So that's not true. And plus, even the only reason even the 50% is as high as it is that we don't have as many kids as we don't have as many children as white people do. They have actually 6 million more children in single-parent homes than we do. I'd also say it's not true that shying away from confronting racism is more common among men than women. Women do it just as much. As far as non-white people, Asians and whoever else, Hispanics or whoever is making a living wage, they're just doing what white people are allowing them to do. it's not anything special that they're doing. They've been allowed to do that, and when they go on their quest to do those things, they don't get disturbed like we do and get freeways built over their businesses and mass incarceration and everything else, and all of these being all these penalties for not separating each other. And the white people come in and they divide us and they force us to be separate from one another. And the last thing that I wanted to say, I want to say a lot of other things, but I'll just say one more thing. In terms of unarmed black men being murdered, I think we've been trained to keep emphasizing this unarmed thing, or whether they're being murdered or being beaten up or whatever the case may be. It wouldn't be any more righteous if they were armed, because they don't go around and just murder armed white people or anyone else for that matter, for the most part. So whether they're armed or not, as long as they are not a threat, it is murder, and it is wrong to murder them or beat them up. And I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Ivy. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Yes, the benefits of the book, you can learn just by reading the quotes that Pam and I think whoever was the other person or persons who did the writings. And there's a few that stands out for me, starting in chapter 20. Do blacks fear, resent, and distrust whites? Absolutely. Whether we admit it or not, it is natural to distrust a member of a group that has a history of mistreating your group. Right on the next page, I am quite certain that there will never be healing between blacks and whites in this country until whites face up to the crime we as a people committed against people of African descent and begin to set it right. That's the only way blacks will ever be able to genuinely respect us. This is something that she is quoting from this white female, I believe, by the name of Donna Lamb, which is kind of like really deceptive as a quote is concerned. So I actually made a mistake in reading that one. But anyway, the axiom, in a system of white supremacy, it is natural for black people collectively to fear and resent white people collectively. That's what I really meant to read. Moving on to the next page, we hide, she says here, under the dangers of black denial. When we hide our true feelings about racism, we're not protecting white people. We're protecting ourselves from the wrath of white people. We've learned from the painful and sometimes fatal experiences of others who have dared to speak out that many whites cannot handle an honest dialogue about racism and will deny racism is happening even when it is happening right under their noses. I certainly personally experienced that quite a bit. Instead of confronting and correcting the source of our pain, we self-medicate with food, alcoholism, drug addictions, violence, ego trips, risky sexual behaviors, infidelity, promiscuity, poor parenting, obesity, overspending, materialism, violence, irrationality, and over-emotionalism. Certainly true from my observations and even some personal mistakes myself. Many blacks avoid examining their true feelings about racism because they are terrified that once they do, they won't be able to continue functioning, smiling, grinning, tap dancing, denying, and pretending as an inferior person with a white supremacist, black-hating society. There are so many. I know I would run out of time. I know I would run out of time as far as they're concerned, especially in this particular section of the reading that she is doing a very good job of. The last thing I would mention is about Mr. Woods, that, you know, even with all of that, self of him giving his descriptions, VGQ, about him, about himself from a racial standpoint. One thing that was definite when he got arrested and what they put on that racial description, they did not put that what he described. That is quote unquote white power. And I would give it to somebody else to speak. Thank you.
Retired firefighter didn't say that was white privilege. He said that is white power. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
Yes, my beard.
Mr. Demery Four.
Okay, I'll start with, she was, you know, early before integration. Despite our limited resources, black people once had a reputation for being the most generous and forgiving people in the nation. You know, it seemed to be, to me, you know, that there was a time when, you know, that exists, and where, you know, the elderly people in the community could, you know, exact punishment on, you know, kids if, you know, if it was justified, and then tell a parent about it, and then the parent would get you, you know, laid on too. And before integration, black men and women, regardless of income and education, knew that they needed each other and knew there was safety in numbers. You know, that had seemed to change. And then black children used to reap the benefit of having, you know, a grandparent, grandma, you know, living with them. They don't have that anymore. And then, well, we got to always bring up the media, you know, and where it bombards the images of happiness, and sexiness, status, success, materialistic type, the way celebrities live and all that, to showcase and bombard the black minds with false images, and to get you to assimilate into, you know, the way that the white majority feels. So if you start to identify with that and become more materialistic, then the more self-centered you'll become, and then the self-destruction of your black identity. But then, so that leads into the last thing she was talking about, is the self-identified black, you know, where I guess she gave a pretty accurate description, where black people identify at every income level, from the most exclusive gated communities to Ivy League campuses. They take on the identification of the white people. So the way that you view black people is similar to the way that white people view black people. And by that time, you, if you knew what was going on, what you'd have to admit that that's showing some degree of psychological damage. So I'll mute my line on that, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four. The number again, 641-715-3000.
3640, the code 564943, pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other folks that we've not heard from, proceed. Did we nab everybody? Anybody with a hand up that we've not heard from?
If I can be heard, I'll say something very quickly.
Jay in St. Louis.
I wanted to talk about in the last section, she talked about how the white identification could spread and what white identification is and how connected it was to a basis in the group. And for me, that really made me think about the social consciousness she was trying to talk about, especially at this split that she presents with integration, which I definitely understand the pushback against that. But I think the split, just theoretically, I think it's interesting. She shows how culturally what white people consume as entertainment ends up becoming what black people strive to be. And the imposition of those kind of things, I think, definitely have a huge influence in determining how we view ourselves, our aims, our goals, and whether or not we even dare to listen to writers like Pam, because what she's saying is very intuitive. I, like one of the callers on the first segment, I used to think similarly that we were being too hard on white people or, you know, something like that. But in a lot of ways, we've really been culturally taught and conditioned to reject these things right off the bat and just not listen to them, not listen to the real intuitiveness and common sense that this really is. That's all I wanted to say.
Much obliged, Jay in St. Louis. Dr. Vanessa Grubbs, author of hundreds of Interlaced Fingers, Medical Apartheid is mentioned. Or actually, I take that back. I don't think Medical Apartheid is mentioned in that book, but same field of study. She came to Seattle and called Gus T. militant. 10 years militant. Too hard on those whites. Woo! Other folks that have commentary that they would like to share?
I have additional commentary when the opportunity presents itself.
Let's see. Did we miss anyone? Anybody that we missed completely have commentary? I will assume everybody is good. Proceed, retired firefighter.
Yes, Ms. Evans, a victim of racist white supremacy, person that I really admired and learned from. She can use these two words in her book, and it's relative. But I would say that the two words, segregation and integration, are perhaps the most two demonstrative words that was devised in the quote unquote 20th century, especially it had its zenith in, I would say, the latter half of the 20th century, because the effect that it's had on non-white people has been tremendous as far as the results of confusion. I don't hear the two words as much in what is called the 21st century. And for something that is good to my mind anyway, is that I do hear in replacement, which actually is the most accurate term, I do hear more and more white supremacy. I am hearing that quite a bit more than what I have heard in the 20th century, using that term to describe racism. I've heard the word white supremacy quite more than what I've heard in the 20th century. And that's just my observation. Thank you.
Before we move to the next caller, you said, if you could just share, what was the nature of what you called something deceptive about what cures Donna Lamb is quoted as having said in the book, Donna Lamb, suspected racist?
Oh, first of all, limiting the system of racism and white supremacy is something that's called this country. And a lot of times when I hear even a non-white person say that, I cringe. But when I hear a white person say that, I identify that as practicing racism, white supremacy, because they know better than that. They know that racism is a global dynamic. And if there is a country, the name of it is white supremacy, as far as that's concerned. I actually did not mean to read that part. I underlined it from the standpoint of acknowledging that that was a white person who that probably identifies herself as a quote-unquote anti-racist white person. And I think Pam did even mention about that particular name description, incorrect name description earlier in the readings. Did I answer your question?
Absolutely.
I did a lot of talking.
You did answer. Okay. You did answer the question. Yes, sir.
Did it make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I'm
still learning too.
me too. Still learning. Other folks, any other commentary they want to make sure that you get in before we conclude?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Ivy.
Yes, I just love this book. I love that she talked about the importance of judging whites collectively instead of individually, because we'll develop faulty conclusions. There's some note that I have here that I don't know, so I'll move on. The flesh color band-aids and that being normal, as opposed to, and just looking at a band-aid like, oh, it's like your skin is not normal. When you put one on, you think of it from that perspective. That was awesome. And last week when she talked about the mini revolts, like, because you talk about all the time, Gus, how that has been eliminated, or whites try to hide that a lot. I like how she brought up northern slavery, about how they, because that was said last week as well, how they always try to talk about slavery just being in the South. I like how she talked, I think that was last week as well, when she talked about mass incarceration, and I want to say she brought up Michelle Alexander. I mean, that was pretty shrewd on white people's part in terms of, you know, mass incarceration, because no one cares about prisoners, because they just look at them as people to be feared and all of that. So they don't care that, you know, they, people with a record, they don't get housing, and they just get denied a lot of things that they need to survive. She talked about a place called Fairfield. It's like white people, they will always find a way to put that word fair in something, airfare and everything else. I like how she brought up Lincoln and how he wasn't about us being equal. And last couple of things I wanted to say, you know, like the terrorists who enslaved our ancestors, they got reparations, which is just a disaster. I like how she talked about how we didn't put Japanese people in internment camps, but we had to pay reparations, and how I think Red even said that we had to with the Jews, and that didn't even happen here. And last thing I want to say real quick, reparations, I think we deserve much more than that. Like, we deserve, like, all the money belongs to us. Like, all of it was made for the whole world economy was made from them enslaving us. And I just wanted to say that I hope everybody on the line has as great a weekend as they can under conditions of systemic white terrorism. A renegade taught me that phrase. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Ivy. With that, I again really wish I had been able to locate the audio segment where Pam the Great was here talking about Superstorm Sandy and the racism that was practiced there. I thought that would have been so timely with the storm, but I could not track it down. I thought I had pretty much locked in exactly where we would have discussed that segment, and I just could not. I remember reading because she blogged about it, and I found the blog post. We blogged about it. I read the blog post. We talked. That was a big deal. I'm sure a lot of people remember that. The two children, where they were just allowed to drown in the storm. But she talked about it on this broadcast. I wanted to get that in. If a listener is able to track it down before I can, drop me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. We will be picking up next Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, for the fourth installment, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. You can feel free to drop an email if you are listening to the archives. Again, there's been an issue with uploading at iTunes. Hopefully that'll be corrected immediately. And in the meantime, the archives are available. All of the archives for this study session and, you know, the workplace racism from yesterday, Dr. Curry's visit on Wednesday, all of those archives are available at Black Talk Radio Network. All of that is available at SoundCloud. All of that is available at YouTube. All of that is available at Google Play. There are many, many, many outlets to get the cows. Archives, that is a part of racism, white supremacy, and making things very difficult, especially if it is potentially, maybe even constructive for non-white people, black people, make it difficult, make it cumbersome for them to access. Remember Hurricane Katrina, we don't want to make it easy for them to be able to get to safety. Again, folks in the Virginia Carolinas, man, I hope you took the warnings seriously and were able to extricate yourself, folks that you care about, and get someplace safe. Hope that you do not have a whole lot of damage to major property or anything else. Man, be safe as possible. It's been my experience, and according to the evidence, racists, they take advantage of these type of situations to just further terrorize black people. So be mindful of that if you are in those locations. With that, much obliged to everyone for participating. I hope it was a constructive investment of your evening. You can get this book at Amazon. You can get the Kindle edition, and you can read right along. Be ready to roll with the study session. Go to writetoamazon.com. Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. And write a review. That's something Pam talked about all the time. Write a review if you are listening, and or particularly every single person, if you are participating in the book study, you should write a review. If you have not already, write a review for the book. That's something that she talked about. She talked about the importance of how that helps to sell books. The more reviews you have, makes the book more popular at Amazon. So write a review, something she would appreciate. And again, not being spectators, 5 sentences. Shouldn't take that long. Go ahead and write a review for Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. And again, the Kindle, I think it's like $3. Very inexpensive. Get copies, share copies. Reading is more important than watching television. That's it. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Dr. Welsing, and I'm pretty sure Pamela Evans Harris would concur. Sobriety would be best for us. Let's take care of our health, well-being. War is being waged against us. We need to be thinking clearly so that we can come up with a permanent solution to the problem. in addition to being sober each and every time we get in a vehicle. Let's be buckled up, driver or passenger. Let's do everything that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.